Most of us do not need or particularly want to think about the fate of foster children. They are taken away from their parents, their protectors in theory, because of abuse or neglect. Child welfare workers do the work of making sure the children are placed with foster parents and keep tabs on them. But the child welfare workers have many, many cases and not a great deal of time to focus on any one case. Enter the CASA, or Court-Appointed Special Advocate. CASA programs exist across the country, putting volunteers onto child welfare cases to speak up for the child's needs. Today, we'll learn more about the workings of CASA on a daily and long-term basis. Our guests are all from the CASA program serving Jackson and Josephine counties. Winona Spivak is the program manager here in the studio. Winona, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Joe Tonkovich is here, too. He's a CASA and peer coordinator. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Corey McGarian is here. She's also a CASA.
Thank you.
And we have Mary Pat Power, also a CASA and peer coordinator. Welcome you, Mary Pat.
Good morning.
While we're actually here on the subject of the different titles, why don't we talk about what a peer coordinator does? Joe, you want to take that one on?
Well, a peer coordinator is sort of a new program with the Rogue Valley's CASA program. A peer coordinator basically is a mentoring program for new CASAs. We peer coordinators try to fill in information between ourselves and the supervisors, the staff, the CASA staff. So if the new CASA has a question, we can help with that question and give them guidance as to what action they should take.
Corey, are you the newest at CASA in the room? Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, I am.
Right, how long a CASA?
I've been with them for a year.
Well, all right, let's start with that then. I mean, okay. What got you into the program in the first place? What appealed you about the CASA program? And move closer to the microphone if you don't
okay,
mind.
Okay, sure. Basically helping to have a voice for the child. I had seen the little ad in the paper for years and done other volunteer work and decided it was time to move forward, called Winona and got on board with the program, and just being there for children, connecting the dots when they don't have a voice, and working with all the lawyers and the medical team and everything else, and putting together all the pieces for the children, and just being that one positive influence in their life and that one constant that they can depend on.
How constant is it? I mean, how often when you're a CASA do you get to see the child who you're matched with?
I try to see my CASA child once a week. And in the meantime, then I talk to other people, her teacher, counselor, check in with the foster mom.
And so you're really just making sure that you're the connecting link in all the people who have contact with that child.
Exactly, yes.
Because I know that caseworkers only have to see the child once a month, right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's correct.
So you're much more
comfortable. And I'd actually like to see her more often, but, you know, it just depends on the situation. And we're all have other things going on. And once a week is really more than I think than is expected. But to me, that's a good flow for the child also, just to keep in touch. And, you know, she remembers our conversations, and then, you know, she sees me coming, her face lights up, and it's a real positive influence.
Mary Pat Power, how long have you been doing CASA work?
I've been with CASA for 7 years, 6 years working directly with kids and their families, and then been a peer coordinator for the last year. So the one thing I wanted to mention is a lot of these kids are actually in the home with their biological parent or parents. They aren't all placed in foster homes. So that's actually everybody's first choice. It's that the kids can stay with their families, or they may be with grandparents or aunts. So that's just important to remember, that we're first choice is keep them with family or in the home if possible.
All right, but a CASA comes in when a case is created.
Yes,
the child
right,
is removed from the home.
When the child becomes a ward of the court.
Right. So, Winona Spivak, how many CASAs are there across Jackson and Josephine counties, and is that number enough?
So, currently we have about 190 CASAs spanning both counties, and it is definitely not enough. Right now, today, we have over 275 children on our wait list waiting for CASAs. We would love to see a day where we have CASAs waiting for children. And so, we're constantly recruiting. We have a new training starting on September 8th if anyone's interested in becoming a CASA and following in the footsteps of our wonderful CASAs and peer coordinators here today. Give us a call at the CASA office or visit our website, and we'll get you started on that process. We have an orientation every Thursday from 12 to 1. You can drop in and learn more about CASA, so please feel free to come to that. You don't have to call and let us know ahead of time, and we'll get you started on that process. So we definitely want every child by the year 2018. Our goal as CASA of Jackson Josephine County is to have every child in the system have a CASA. And we have a little ways to go before that happens. And it's a wonderful opportunity for a sort of average, everyday community citizen to make an extraordinary difference in the life of a child.
When you said there are 190 CASAs right now, 275 kids waiting. How many kids are served, though, total?
So we are serving about 600 kids right now in both counties.
All right. So we're talking almost half again,
yes.
still needing that. That assistance. All right.
Well,
we have much more to talk about the CASA program with our guests here in the studio. Winona Spivak, Mary Pat Power, Corey McGarian, and Joe Tonkovich back to talk about the CASA program and the training and all that entails and the actual day-to-day work of the CASA and what that entails as well. And we'll take your questions and comments if you'd like to join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can get a look at our speakers on our Facebook page. That picture just went up 3 minutes ago, so you can see who we're talking to here in the studio. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk to the CASAs and you in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about the CASA program. CASA standing for Court Appointed Special Advocate. They just call themselves CASAs, and you can too. We have four guests from the program from Jackson and Josephine counties here to talk about what CASAs do generally and some of the specific challenges in Jackson and Josephine counties. Winona Spivak is the program manager, Joe Tonkovich and Mary Pat Power, CASAs and peer coordinators, Corey McGarian, a CASA with about a year under her belt. You can join the discussion on the exchange here at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Joe Tonkovich, I want to come back to you. I'm going to guess you've been with the program a fair number of years.
6 years.
6 years, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And how many different cases have you been attached to at that point? How many different kids have you gotten to know, or sets of kids?
Well, I've just been reminded I have had 12 children in several cases. I'm not sure of the number of cases, but presently I have two cases that I'm working on.
And what is the maximum you want to run up to, Winona Spivak? I mean, I'm aware I have foster kids in my own home and have for 9 years now, but what is the state caseload for the workers at DHS, the Department of Human Services, is great. What is the caseload you give the CASAs, though?
So we love our CASAs to take around two cases. They can take up to three. That's national standard, and some have one. And it also depends on the number of children per case. We have a lot of large family groups. We might have one case with seven children, and that would be enough for one CASA to be able to sufficiently manage and give that 360-degree perspective. So we say one to three cases is ideal.
Let's talk about some history then. I mean, how the CASA program got started nationwide and why? I mean, what was the need that was perceived that led to the creation of this?
So in 1977, a juvenile court judge in Seattle said, hey, I'm making some really tough decisions regarding where these children are going in their lives and their permanent placement, and I feel like I'm just not getting as much input as I need. I would really love to have someone be able to get to know this child, build rapport, have that consistent presence in this child's life, report back to me from an objective place what's going on with this child and what's in this child's best interest. And so from that, the judge conceptualized and began the program out of Seattle, and it's just spread like crazy across the country. And we have, I think, 49 states have programs and over 1,000 programs across the nation, CASA or guardian ad litem GAL programs. And it really was so that the judge could have as much information as possible to make the best decision for the best interest of that child.
Is it was the need perceived certainly by the judge because the relationship between biological parents and child welfare workers tends to be somewhat adversarial? This was somebody who would take a more child-centered approach?
Correct. We are very child-centric. And additionally, we know the attorneys have high caseloads. Caseworkers have high caseloads. And so the CASA can really get to know that child and provide more up-to-date information on a weekly, daily basis about what's going on with that child's situation, really get to know the child, really present the the detailed information to the judge so that he or she can make that best decision for the child's best interest.
Mary Pat Power, tell us a bit about the whole training process, because you're involved. You've been involved with them both ends
right,
now.
Right. The training process is 40 hours spread over 8 or 4 weeks.
Which already
Winona's
makes it,
telling me.
Which already makes it greater in number of hours than the foster parents themselves get, I should point out.
That's true. That's true. So we get become familiar with the system itself. There's a whole court system to become familiar with, all the different aspects of a case. We're working with attorneys, with mental health people, the schools, how to interact with those resources. We actually go and observe some of the court proceedings, the hearings that are held, become familiar with how to write a report for the court, practice doing that. I think I'm missing a few things, but it's really really excellent. And then there's ongoing in service and workshops so that we can continue to learn more and keep up to speed when there are changes.
Obviously, you're not functioning as a lawyer in this capacity, but you have to get familiar with some legal terms, it would seem, Winona.
Correct. And we have a whole list of acronyms and different glossary terms that we give to the CASAs. We mentor them through that. And that's a great role, the peer coordinator as well, because the peer coordinator can continue to mentor the CASA around what this means, what you're going to see when you go to court, what this term means, what the judge is doing, procedural issues. So the peer coordinators can actually accompany the CASAs to the court for their first court appearances and kind of explain to them, this is the application of the knowledge you learned in the classroom.
And so Corey McGarian, since you had the training most recently, were there parts of this 40 hours when you were scratching your head thinking, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself
into?
What
am I doing? Well, the saving grace to that is the fabulous support in the CASA office. So, you know, I think almost any time of the day if I have a question, I can just pick up the phone and call. And everything is so well laid out that, you know, people are reachable. The information's there. We have a big binder. And I like to just spend time going to court and hearing the cases to become more familiar.
And so, you know, I had a chance to be in a child welfare hearing a few years ago and observe that what the parents were asking for and what the CASAs were asking for were different things, mm-hmm. which can present some interesting moments, I'm mm-hmm. sure. And I hear you agreeing here, Joe Tonkovich. You've been in this situation, it sounds like.
Well, there's a definite distinction between parties in a case and what their roles are. The CASA represents what is in the best interest of the child, not what's in the best interest of the parents or the best interest of the social services or any other party. Many times the best interests coincide with what DHS is seeking, what the attorney for the child wants, what the parents want. And when that happens, things work well. But we sometimes have to come into conflict with other parties if we believe that the child's best interests are not being served. So, yes, there is some division there.
Let us take a phone call. Here is Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the CASA program with Joe Tonkovich, Winona Spivak, Corey McGarian, and Mary Pat Power.
Folks, I have tremendous respect for what you do, and I bow down to you. I'd like to help, but I work 40 hours a week full time. How do I help?
All right, let's find out. Thanks for that, Paul.
That's a great question, and I would like to pass it over to Corey McGarian, our new CASA, who also works probably about 80 hours a week.
Yes, so I work full-time also, and the great thing about this program is there's so much flexibility. You can do it in your off hours. There's always paperwork to do, you know, when 11 o'clock at night. There's phone calls to be made on your lunch break. I work my visitation with my CASA gal into lunchtime or on the weekends or after work, and I don't know what your line of work is, but I'm able to break away often. And, you know, so that's the great thing about the program is the flexibility and the way we're able to just work it out.
What is your full-time job, Corey?
I work at an assisted living facility in Ashland, and I'm event planner and activity director.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopping.
So between activities, you get a chance to come out and take care of the CASA stuff.
Yes.
And I want to add for Paul that the great purpose of the peer coordinator position as well is to assist the CASA. If the CASA can't make a hearing or a meeting, the peer coordinator can be there in his stead to provide input and to take notes and deliver that back to the CASA.
And, and also, the our job as CASAs isn't a five-day-a-week, 40-hour a week job. You can apply your talents at any time, 24/7. So weekends, if you're working full-time during the week, you can do a lot of these things on the weekend, although a lot of people aren't available on the weekend. But you can visit your child and get to know the foster parents or the parents, that sort of thing. So there's many opportunities, whether you're full-time employed or not, to be a CASA.
Winona, did I understand you to say that the training is generally on the weekends? So we're assuming your job is a Monday-Friday thing, you're making a face.
Yeah, so the, so the training...
Having people in the studio.
That's right. So the training actually takes place during the day typically. Mm-hmm. And the CASA would need to take time off from work to attend the training. But after that, daytime meetings would consist of court hearings, family decision meetings, 90-day staffings, those sorts of things, which court hearings typically are scheduled far in advance. And so individuals are aware of when those are and can plan their schedule accordingly.
It seems like at least 3 weeks' notice on the court hearings usually, isn't it?
That's the norm, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so there was something in here about funding. There was a discussion there at some point. Let me remind our listeners, we're talking about the CASA program, the Court-Appointed Special Advocate program, specifically the Jackson and Josephine County program, but it is similar to other CASA programs around the country that assist children by giving them a representative when they have cases in front of the child welfare system in whatever state. Our guests are Winona Spivak, the program manager at Jackson Josephine County CASA, Joe Tonkovich, CASA and peer coordinator, Mary Pat Power, also CASA and peer coordinator, Corey Magarian, who's been CASA for about a year now. Join us on the exchange if you have questions or comments. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Starting to ask about funding and how CASA is funded. Now, I know that CASA in Jackson County used to be separate from CASA in Josephine County. Now it's all one thing. I presume that was some issue having to do with the availability of public funds.
So what happened is CASA of Jackson County used to be part of the under the auspices of the county, and with budgetary needs for the county, CASA had to go out on its own and find its own funding. Similarly, the situation happened in Josephine County. So about 2 years ago, CASA of Jackson County said, we want to help our sister county program. And so we took under the auspices of CASA in Jackson County, which now became CASA of Jackson and Josephine County. So we help provide some of their funding and help them look for grants and fundraising, much as we do for CASA of Jackson County here in Medford and Ashland.
Do you still try to keep the CASAs closer to their closer courthouse, basically?
We do. And what's really great about the addition of CASA of Josephine County is we have a couple of CASAs who are dual appointed in both counties, and we have some sibling groups who are split. So one sibling might live in Grants Pass, one might live in Medford, and so it's a really unique situation for the CASA to be in which they can advocate in both of those court systems for both of those children.
Dual appointed, which gets us back to the first two letters of CASA, court appointed. So Joe Tonkovich, tell us about that. You actually get sworn in and do all that stuff?
Yeah, I had a case that closed after a year, and then it opened up again. This time, though, the parents were living, or the father was living in Josephine County, so the venue for the case changed. I received a call from the caseworker or an intake worker from DHS in Josephine County asking me, after she saw my name in the file, whether or not I would be interested in becoming the CASA once again. So I had to be sworn in Josephine County and work with the Josephine County CASA to work with this case, which I did. So I had a split personality there.
And Mary Pat Power, you wanted to add a detail?
Well, a CASA is actually a legal party to the case. We're listed there with the attorneys, the DHS caseworker, and when a decision is going to be made regarding a petition, it says the CASA opposes this motion or agrees with this motion. We have just as much voice as anyone else.
And I have noticed, too, that CASA seem to have access to documents and files and things that are not necessarily even available to the foster parents.
That's correct. The foster parents are not legal parties to the case. And the CASA is in a very unique position in that the CASA is the only legal party that has access to 99.9% of the DHS case file, everything in that case file, all of the discovery, anything related to the child's educational, psychological, medical history. We present our appointment orders, and we are allowed to have access to medical information, educational information, psychological information with no questions asked, because we are duly appointed to represent the best interests of that child by the court.
Mary Pat Power, I want to ask you about the process of getting to know the kids. I mean, you're representing a child in court, but the point is to have a personal relationship with the child as well. At a time in their lives when there's obviously a fair amount of stress. And so what's the process? I mean, how are you trained to go about to getting to know the child and try to not add to the stress that child's already feeling?
Well, that's actually the nice part of the job. You're hearing all this about court reports and the legal system and everything, but this is the nice part of getting to know the child. So everybody does it in their own way. But basically, it's going to meet the child in a familiar place and just very slowly getting to know them. It can be very different. You know, I've worked with a 2-year-old. I've worked with teenagers. So obviously, that's pretty different. You know, they're looking for someone at a stressful time in their life. And here comes somebody who just wants to get to know them, who you know, we're not a doctor, we're not a therapist, we're just, you know, we can get down on the floor and play with a child or a teenager, you know, take them out to eat. Like I said, that's the enjoyable part of the process. And then going back to see them, they're glad to see you. You might see them at school. It's great.
So, Corey, I'm curious, Corey McGarry, and I'm curious about what you explained to the kid, because the child's going to know, well, who are you and what are you to me? And obviously, we can talk about court-appointed special advocates and intervener status and all that stuff, but this is not going to make sense to an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, whatever. So how do you initiate that conversation with the child?
Well, actually, in my case, the most current gal that I'm with, her foster parent explained to her ahead of time that I was a friend of somebody's. And so she hasn't asked me those questions. So when I get together with her, you know, I'm playing with her. We meet at the park, and I'll say, let's go on the swings. She says, really? You want to swing with me? I said, of course. So we run off to the swings and then, you know, color together. We talk about her favorite color crayon and whatever comes up. So, you know, playing with bugs on the ground, anything to connect, and she seems to love that. So
is the point, Winona Spivak, to observe in addition to – I mean, what's the mix here of comfort versus observe versus any other functions that you're trying to do in one-to-one relations with the child?
Great question. And I think it's different in every situation, but the main purpose is to build a relationship with this child so that you can advocate effectively for him or her and to – you're investigating. So part of the CASA role is to investigate – hopefully from a 360-degree perspective, you're gathering all the evidence you can, information you can, whether it's observational, whether it's documentation, whether it's what the parents say, the foster parents say, and you are analyzing all this information and putting together sort of your recommendations based on these facts that you have heard, seen, and really observed in many, many different situations. So we tell the CASAs, meet the kid at school, talk to the school teachers, meet the kid at their home, meet the kid at the foster home, take the kid out, meet the kid at an after-school activity. So you can really get that rounded perspective of what's happening in this child's life, who the child's supports are, where the child finds safety, who the child enjoys being around, what the child enjoys doing. So you are investigating all of that and wrapping that up into your recommendations based on those facts that you've seen.
And so, Joe Tonkovich, just the pieces of paper that you as a CASA prepare, I mean, how is that going to be a big pile by the time the case is closed?
Most of our paperwork has to do with review of other people's documents, the case file, assessments by therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists. The documents we generate somewhat depends on our style of management of the case. Personally, I take copious notes of everything I do. And from those notes, I prepare reports and so on. There's not a lot of writing that we have to do. It's not difficult from that point of view. If a prospective volunteers are worried about the writing and the generation of reports. Don't worry about that. There's a lot of support on that regard to that kind of thing.
So don't get freaked out by the paperwork if you're thinking about becoming a CASA, because there's lots of other paperwork to look at. We'll come back and talk more about the CASA program with representatives for the program in Jackson and Josephine counties. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, we've got a couple of phone calls waiting. We'll take more and take your emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with the CASA folks in a minute 10. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about the CASA program, the Court-Appointed Special Advocate Program. You can call the volunteers CASAs. That's what they call themselves. And what they do is step in to represent a child's needs when a child's case is opened before a child welfare department in any state. There are 49 states running CASA programs right now. So this is not the foster parent. It is not the caseworker from the Department of Human Services in Oregon's case. It is somebody sort of in the middle of it all, getting to know the child and to be able to represent the child's needs in court. CASA program in Jackson Josephine counties has about 190 CASAs right now, could use a whole lot more. And maybe this is something that appeals to you. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with comments or questions at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call. Here's Jenny in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. So I was just calling in a testimonial. I'm a fairly new CASA. I've just finished my first case up in Douglas County. And so I just wanted to let everybody know in the listening area that there's CASA opportunities probably in the whole listening area. And having just finished my one case, I've been looking at where the other cases are. There's lots of families who are out in rural areas, foster families or biological families. And so they're always looking for people who aren't necessarily in town, who might be able to reach hard-to-reach kids. And so I also wanted to just say it's been a really enriching experience for me. I'm not naturally a child person at all, so I'm not quite sure why I decided this was a good idea. But
you wanted to do something, has it met your expectations? Has it exceeded them? I mean, is it totally different from what you thought you'd find?
It's exceeded my expectations. It's been really, to be a full party to a case like this is such a privilege, to see every aspect of what's going on. And then, like you said about the foster parents, realizing that there are people who are very deeply involved with the children who don't necessarily have all the facts at their disposal. Not that I'm there to give them that information, but it means that not everybody knows everything, and that's not helpful for the children at times. And when I first stepped into the case, there were so many people involved that I just couldn't, I wasn't, and my kids are very young, so it's not that we're very young, so I didn't really, it wasn't like they needed me as a friend or a supporter. I mean, they had a lot of family in their lives and so on, so I really felt a bit like a spare part. But the first time I realized that there was some important documentation that wasn't being passed between the education district and social services, and it just really surprised me. It was just important things, and just it's a big bureaucracy and everybody's busy and some things just got missed, and I spotted that, and it was so exciting, like, oh, I'm important.
All right, you got to be able to make a difference in the case then. Yes. All right, Jenny, thanks so much for sharing the story, and thanks for taking part in the CASA program. It's good to talk to you today. So that raises the question, when Jenny was talking about she's not a really good child person, not a child person, she's just good. I want to just make sure I don't restate what she said. She said she's not really necessarily a child person. So what kinds of people are you looking for? Who are the people who make good CASAs, Winona Spivak?
So what I tell people when they're asking about whether they could become a good CASA, I say, do you have a heart for children? Not necessarily do you love children and always want to be around them, but do you have a heart for children and want to make a difference in a child's life for the benefit of your family's community and the world globally? Can you maintain some sort of objectivity? Can you advocate and really speak up for the best interest of this child when it comes down to it? So that's what I say makes a good CASA. You don't have to be a lawyer. You don't have to be a doctor. You don't have to be a social worker. You don't have to be a teacher. Although we do have many. We have retired attorneys, retired teachers, retired doctors, current doctors. But you don't need to have a very specific profession in order to be a good CASA. You just need to be able to know that this child needs help, needs support, needs advocacy, and be able to stand up and do that when it comes time to do that.
The Casa I Know Best ran an Italian restaurant. So, yeah, it really, whatever skill you have that you can bring to the table here. How extensive are the background checks? Mary Pat Power, can you give us some idea of how much, how many questions got asked and how many forms you had to fill out when you got in?
Actually, I don't remember. I'm sure they did a criminal background check, and I had to submit fingerprints. Mm-hmm. But I had to do that when I was a teacher and a counselor also. So Winona can probably speak to that more.
Yeah, so what we do with CASAs is we do a full background check. We do a criminal history check. We do fingerprints. We run those through the Oregon State Police. We do a sex offender registry check. We also do 3 references at least. Many CASAs turn in more than that. We do an interview process and ask, it's about an hour and a half long interview to determine if this is a good fit for them. And then we're also assessing and evaluating CASAs as they go through the training process as much as they're evaluating us. It's kind of they're looking at us to see if it's a good fit. We're looking at them to see if it's a good fit. And then with the peer coordinator model, we're really looking at how they're moving through their first case to see if it is an appropriate fit for them. But up front, we run a very extensive criminal background check to ensure that there is nothing in their record that would preclude them from working with children.
Let us take another phone call. Here's Bill in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the folks from CASA, Winona Spivak, Joe Tonkovich, Corey McGarrion, and Mary Pat Power.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me. I have a question, maybe suggestion. I, about 20-some years ago, I was a big brother before I was even married and had my son, and I just wondered if that'd be a good resource for you to possibly pull more people in, because big brothers could probably cover some of that too, or big sisters, and you know, work together and maybe get twice as many people to work within the system.
All right. Yeah. All right, thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it. Winona, what are your thoughts? I mean, you don't want to necessarily poach people from other organizations.
But. We don't. But, you know, if anyone's interested in doing multiple volunteer opportunities at the same time, that's not outside the realm of possibilities with a CASA. Mary
Pat? Actually, I don't know about Josephine County, but in Jackson County, there is not a Big Brother, Big Sister program, is my understanding. I was just talking about that with someone recently, that's a lack, and there are a lot of people who maybe wouldn't even want to be a CASA, but would be interested in being a big brother, a big sister.
And to kind of segue from what Mary Pat is saying, with our CASA program, we have a special part of our program called the Mighty CASA, Mentoring Youth Towards Independence. These CASAs work with older teens and younger teens as well, from 13 to 18. And this CASA takes an additional opportunity to mentor these youth as they transition into adulthood, connecting them with housing resources, with socialization opportunities, with financial planning information, with anything and everything we can possibly think of to transition them into adulthood, and also to be that mentor for them as they move into adulthood as well, to provide that stable person who's going to be with them. Because oftentimes with foster children, as you know, before they age out, everything's done for them. And then when they hit 18, now they're on their own. And so the CASA can also stay past that 18-year-old birthday and stay with this CASA kiddo until they're 21 or for the rest of their life. We have a CASA who worked with a CASA teen, and he went to her high school graduation. He went to her college graduation. He's still a very much a big part of her life. And that's what we hope that our CASAs, if they choose to, and with the input of the guardian of the child, to stay in that child's life and provide that consistent presence as they transition into adulthood and thereafter.
So, Winona Spivak, how are you going to go about trying to ramp up the program? If you have 660 children served by the CASAs now, you're going to need another 40 or 50 CASAs, it would seem like, to be able to get the waiting list from 275 to nothing. There's always the hope that, of course, there'll be fewer child abuse cases, and therefore the need will drop. At the same time, the supply of people as CASAs will go up. But, I mean, that's going to take additional people, I would think, additional paid staff as well as volunteer staff.
Well, so it's interesting you mentioned that, because part of the reason we implemented the peer coordinator model is because our budget is stretched. We operate off of fundraising, off of grants, off of major donations, and there's really not a lot more funding out there that we can look to. So we implemented the peer coordinator model to assist so we wouldn't have to add more paid staff and run the risk of not being able to sustain that model on a long-term basis. So our peer coordinators really take on that role of coaching and mentoring and guiding our new CASAs to relieve some of that pressure from our paid staff. And we're looking at increasing our number of peer coordinators along with increasing our number of CASAs. So, for example, this new training starting in September, I've got 12 people who are interested in that. And additionally, I'm looking to train at least 4 new peer coordinators. So we're going to fill in the old peer coordinators, and we're going to also add new peer coordinators to help support those new CASAs.
The 275 kids you say are on a waiting list, is that done by triage? Do you decide who is needful of a CASA more than another case, or is it just a first-come, first-served thing and the last ones in don't get anything?
Yeah, so it is a triage system. You're correct. When we have a child who has a special need, whether it's medical, intellectual, any of those special needs, we prioritize those cases. We prioritize children who have had multiple entries into the system. They've come back. Their case is closed. They've come back in. We prioritize children who are either very young and need an extra set of eyes and ears. We also prioritize anyone who requests a CASA. The judges, the power of the CASA program is so obvious when we're sitting in court and the judge says, we need a CASA on this case, or an attorney calls, or a caseworker calls, or a parent. We've had parents call and ask for a CASA on their case for their children. So we prioritize those cases as well when we get a request from a judge, attorney, caseworker, or family member. And it's difficult because we want to. Our goal, again, is to serve every child, but we have to triage in order to serve those who, among this needy group, are the most needy.
If I could add to that, please. On the other side of the coin, you might say, the CASAs themselves have the choice of what kind of a child or case they would like to take. So they're not just assigned any case. If a new CASA wants to work with teenagers, that's his or her option. And if a CASA would prefer to work with infants or very young children who can't communicate very well, that's another option, or boys or girls. So the CASA has the option of choosing the case ultimately.
And did you make any specification, Corey McGarian, when you got into the CASA system about which age range or gender you'd like the best?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did make a specification in the beginning, but after working a week with Winona, I thought I'd start out with a small child, and she thought I'd be best suited for a teenager. So, and it was a great situation. And I think the great thing about the training is we get to know each other, you know, on a more personal level, working those 40 hours together. Winona has such great insight, as does Jennifer, and so they have a good idea by the time the program is complete what we can do also. So we work together collaboratively, and seems to work out. I think, you know, I just can't say enough positive things about the whole connection.
Jennifer is the CASA Executive Director.
Yes.
Jennifer Malenik?
Correct, yeah.
All right. Mary Pat Powell, I had a question for you then. In the years that you've been working as a CASA, I mean, it sounds like a great thing from a lot of people's perspective, because you're doing good things for kids and you get hopefully positive interactions with the kids. But there are, I imagine, a few things that are less happy about it. You know, as Jenny called in from Roseburg, things she had to point out in the documents, things that were getting missed by other people involved in the case. So there must be a few moments when it's like, oh, this is not all fun and games. It's not all just getting to know the kid.
No, it isn't all fun and games. I mean, you're working with children who are in great distress, no matter what their placement is. You're seeing families that often are poor, lots of substance abuse, domestic violence. I mean, it goes on. And in a lot of cases, it's generational. This isn't the first generation of that family that's dealing with this. So it's very hard what you see. It can be frustrating trying to get information, trying to connect people. There are disagreements at times. Joe referred to earlier when I might think this is really what a child needs, and that doesn't work out exactly as I would wish. You know, I keep going back to the kids. That really is an important part of it. But it can be stressful.
I imagine you were well prepared for this, though, by your years as a teacher.
I was, and I was also a counselor. I'm working as a peer coordinator now with people who've had none of that background. One of the CASAs is a travel agent. She has kids of her own. That certainly helps her. But, you know, people, as Winona said, you need a heart for kids. That's what you need.
Winona, do you ever advise CASAS to take a break, to take a few weeks off, take between cases, not be part of it? I mean, do they need a chance to recharge?
Definitely. And I actually, when I first started, had to tell CASA to take the weekend off. She kept working over every weekend. I was like, just take a weekend off. Take it for yourself. So we definitely, I think as a staff and as a team, we try and recognize when CASAS are being affected by that vicarious trauma and try and support them around that. And the peer coordinators do a wonderful job of that as well. But we definitely, if a CASAS is coming off a really difficult case, we say, let's take some time, take a break, and then come back to us when you're ready. That's what we say. And then if it's a couple months, then I call them and harass them and ask when they're coming back. And because they're, it's such a wonderful thing that these CASAS do. And once you get into the CASA work, it's hard to kind of give that up. Mm-hmm. And so as a team, we mobilize and we support our CASAS as much as we can. We try and look out for them and tell them when we think maybe they need a little bit of a break.
And how, well, go ahead.
One of the beauties of the peer coordinator aspect of this is that if a CASA needs a break a month, a lot of us are retired and we travel. And we might be gone for a month at a time or a couple of weeks. The peer coordinator can fill in, being familiar with that case, can fill in for that CASA. So there's not the pressure of being tied down. If new volunteers are thinking that they're going to give their lives up for this, that's not the case. They can resume their lives as usual and still be able to do this and do it well with the support that CASA offers.
CASA programs are available across the area. Find the one closest to you if you're interested in taking part. I want to thank our guests from Jackson-Josephine County CASA, Winona Spivak, the program manager, Joe Tonkovich and Mary Pat Power, CASA's and peer coordinators, and Corey McGarry and CASA. Thank you all for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you, thanks for
it's been a pleasure.
Us.